Okay, welcome back to the Strength Training for Runners podcast with myself, Tim Edgerton. And this is a special episode, Strength Training for Runners podcast, and I'm delighted to introduce Dr. Richard Blagrove. So Richard is a senior lecturer in physiology at Loughborough University. He completed his PhD in strength and conditioning for runners. He is also the author of the excellent book, Strength and Conditioning for Endurance Running. He's a former middle distance runner himself with a 153 800 meter PB. Richard's really one of the biggest names in the field of strength and conditioning for elite endurance runners. So really, thank you for coming on the podcast, Richard.
Yeah, no, thanks very much for inviting me on, Tim. And yeah, very few people mention my 153 over 800 meters, which was a long time ago now. But yeah, thanks for mentioning that.
Yeah, well, it's all relevant, you know, experience in the trenches as an athlete as well as a coach and academic. I certainly thought that was worth a mention.
And
we chatted a little bit back and forth online about sort of questions we might cover and in this episode, and I thought it'd be good to go through some stuff that's in your book as well as maybe take some stuff from your PhD thesis as well. So to kick things off, in your book you have a whole section on testing and assessment, and in a world where a lot of people try to complicate things, I guess I appreciated that you made a lot of these tests very accessible. So one of the movement screening tests in your books was like simply a standing rotation. So it's very easy to administer, but you can obviously gather a lot of information from the way an athlete moves in such a simple test. So I just wondered, could you talk us through some of the key things that maybe you're looking for, not just in that test, but maybe it can be in that test in particular, but also just in movement screening in general as well?
Yeah, definitely. So, I mean, you probably know this, Tim, that I guess kind of movement screening and the way that I presented it in my book, like it is quite a controversial area in sort of sports science and medicine, because particularly if we try and score tests and we produce some sort of composite score from a series of different tests, like this, it tends to show it's not very predictive of injury and performance. But what I tried to put across in my book was, if we take any of these tests and we look at the way in which individuals are moving, and if we screen their ability to control the movement, like how kind of stable and balanced they are during the movement, particularly on one leg, and then how mobile they are across different joints on these really basic fundamental tasks, like it can actually be quite insightful. And a lot of the time it can sort of start to unpick maybe why a runner's had a succession of injuries in a certain area, or why their performance might be limited in some ways. So you obviously kind of need a little bit of knowledge and skill of what you're looking for on these tests. And I guess that's why I spent like quite a substantial chapter in my book trying to put across like how to do them and what sorts of things that you need to look for. I think the other thing is that with the sorts of screens that I put across in my book, like they can all be done in a home-based environment. Like they don't really require any kind of kit or resources. And so just executing the movements and trying to follow the instructions that I put across, like it does just sort of try to make runners aware of what they kind of can and can't do. And so they don't just dive straight into a weights room type environment and say, squatting's good for me, so therefore I'm going to pick up a bar, I'm going to put 40, 50 kilograms on it, I'm going to start squatting straight away through as much range as I can, because inevitably they're going to end up getting hurt, or best case scenario, the exercise isn't particularly effective. And then with the standing rotation, so the exercise that you mentioned before, I mean, this is a test that, thinking back quite a long time now, like I nicked it off a couple of physios that I was working with, and they kind of showed me the test and said, oh yeah, we use this a lot with runners, and these are the sorts of things that you need to look for. And it correlates very, very highly with the way the foot in particular behaves on the ground when runners are running. And so, yeah, what I'm looking for with this test is that a runner stands with their arms across their chest, their feet about hip width apart, pointing directly forward, so kind of 12 o'clock on a clock face. And then the main thing I'm looking at is just their feet. And so you get them to rotate using their torso or their upper body about 45 degrees or so. So you get them to kind of turn their upper body 45 degrees. So it's kind of pointing at about 2 o'clock, and then they move around the other way. and it points to, yeah, about 10 o'clock on a clock face. And essentially what you should see, if they're locking the torso correctly, is the their upper leg, so name of the bone is the femur, that starts to rotate one way, and on the other leg it rotates in almost the opposite direction. And then that should cause the lower leg, or the name of the bone would be the tibia, to also rotate. And so what you should see at the foot is kind of this natural kind of rolling across the middle arch, which is known as supination and pronation. And if you get like quite a lot of the time with runners, you get like literally no movement at the feet. So they rotate the trunk and then they kind of compensate somewhere around their lower body in terms of where they get the range from. And it doesn't end up kind of manifesting and producing any sort of movement at the foot. And so, as I say, that usually correlates quite well with how the foot's behaving on the ground when they're running. And if they get no movement at all, it's something that I'd want to try to correct quite quickly. And sometimes the correction can literally be saying, okay, I want you to practice that exercise every day before you go out for a run. And then you can start to practice it on one leg. And then quite quickly over time, they get a little bit more awareness around how they should be loading and unloading at the foot. And it improves the mobility a little bit. And hopefully that should then transfer across to their running.
Very good. So the tests, a lot of these tests, I guess, are sometimes exercises in their own right as well. So you might see maybe two or three tests that you're deficient in, for want of a better word, and say, okay, we'll just practice those tests, whether it be in your warm-up or as part of your strength and conditioning program or whatever the case may be.
Precisely. And I think it's probably going to link to some of the things we'll discuss a little bit later, but I'd often use that movement screen, as you're suggesting, as a way to sort of prescribe and bias the warm-up in certain areas, that if an athlete can't do a certain skill very well, just because they either haven't practiced it a long time or they're really tight in a certain area, they've got a lot of that type of movement in as part of their warm-up before they do the session. And it certainly wouldn't be loaded until they reach the sort of level of competence, which is safe and effective.
Going back to the scoring stuff you mentioned as well, I mean, I think I remember probably about 15 years ago, where I think it's probably when this kind of movement screening, maybe particularly in the UK, took off, maybe a little bit earlier in the USA, but I think it was Gray Cook who came up with the functional movement screen. And you mentioned the score. I think he had a very precise scoring system and then an overall score. So interesting to hear that you've kind of moved away from that and just like not so particular with it, but just using it as a guide and to guide your programming as well.
Yeah, I think that's a really good way to summarize it. Yeah. So I try and avoid producing a score and saying, oh, that score's quite low, you're definitely going to get injured, because a lot of the time it's just simply not the case that you can score quite low and actually go quite long periods of time without getting injured. And equally, the opposite can happen as well. And so, as you say, it's more sort of helping guide the program and helping trying to unpick just for that individual in front of you what areas they're deficient in.
Very good, very good. Aside from the movement screening, and then I guess we mentioned the scoring system as well, because you also cover capacity testing and performance testing in your book. And I guess what I like about these tests is there is actually scoring benchmarks for each test, because it's a different type of testing, isn't it? So I'd be a little bit interested to know your thoughts on this, really, whether you've observed anything and you're able to say maybe for an athlete, whatever it may be, whether it's to reach world cost levels or whether it to be to national standard or whatever standard might be applicable, or if it's even possible to say this at all. But is it possible to say you need to hit certain standards, whether they be sort of, because you scored, you scored them, this test as excellent, satisfactory, or possibly poor, I can't remember. But maybe do athletes need to be scoring excellent across the board if they want to make world class, or do they need to score satisfactory across the board, or for national standard or world class, whatever it may be? Is it possible to say that, or is it not really possible? And again, we should just be treating that more as a guide as well.
Yeah, it is a really, really good question, this. And like in many ways, it's a bit of a sort of surprising and confusing answer.
Yeah.
I guess if we take middle distance runners, first of all, and I don't know how many of you listeners are sort of 800, 1500 runners, but those are our distances, Tim, so it's a good place to start.
Yeah.
Like I think if you look at the research evidence, and certainly a lot of the data that I've collected over the last 20, 25 years, there is a fairly close link between some of these performance and strength-based tests and then performance in the middle distances. And that's mainly because of the demand for sort of maximal speed and anaerobic characteristics. And so typically, if you're getting, particularly across a very large cohort of middle distance runners, if you look at the guys and girls that are really truly world class, like they can typically sprint very fast, they can jump very high, like they're quite bouncy and plyometric, and they'll be very good at some of the other tests that I describe in my book. And that's compared to sort of your club standard 800, 1500 runner. And so there is a bit of a causative link there, that if you get a club standard runner stronger, if you get them more powerful, if you get them a little bit more plyometric, like that should translate to improvements in maximal sprint speed, 400 meter performance, these sorts of things. And so therefore it's going to help the middle distance performance. What I tend to see more with longer distance runners, so here we're talking about sort of 5K up to the marathon, is the link seems to be not quite as well established, or it's not sort of as causative in nature. But I think it's really important not to confuse, like we talk about correlation versus causation a lot in sort of research. It's important not to confuse those two things, that just because like maximal strength or somebody's ability to jump very high doesn't correlate with marathon running performance, let's say, it's not to say it's still not important to become stronger, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So again, if you look at the individual and you look at, okay, over a period of a few months, if we make them a little bit stronger, if we make them a little bit more plyometric and a little bit more explosive, like we've actually got some quite good evidence that at population level of runners, like that will improve things like running economy and performance. And so there might not necessarily be a correlation between those things at a single point in time, but if we improve those things in an individual, it's likely to get improvements in economy and performance. So hopefully that's not sort of too confusing, but that's kind of where I see the link, that it's probably absolutely key for middle distance runners, but it's something we need to be looking to improve in longer distance runners.
Yeah, and I guess it's just on a continuum, isn't it, really? Because I guess if you're looking at sprinters, then the link is even more clear, and wherever you are in the spectrum, it has a level of importance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so you could easily get like a world class, and a lot of people mention like the East Africans, who some of them apparently don't engage very much with strength training, and they'll say, okay, they're very weak and they don't really do very much strength training. But that's not a very convincing argument that strength training isn't necessarily important, because you don't know what type of impact it's going to have in that group of runners. And if we do go to the scientific evidence and we look at all the studies that have used strength training with longer distance runners, like most of the literature will tell us, as we say, it improves economy, time trial performance, maximal sprint speed, which is obviously going to be beneficial.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, as you say, it's a bit of a continuum, and we need to think a bit more critically about it.
And I guess, I don't know what your opinion on this, but to an extent, even the East Africans, oftentimes you could point to an argument that maybe there are still elements of strength and conditioning in what they do. I see a lot of videos recently of like Ethiopian training groups that do a lot of kind of running drills of various types, which obviously has some kind of a plyometric element. And often maybe certain Kenyan training groups, I've seen them do maybe limited amounts of kind of calisthenic type work after a run or something. So it's probably not even true to say they ignore it completely.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's always impossible to know what all of these various different training groups and runners are doing as well, unless you were to go and live with them for extended periods of time. You don't really know. I imagine there's quite a lot of variation, as you say. Elements of S&C which is still having beneficial effects.
Sticking with the testing theme for now, but we've obviously talked about the accessibility of some of the tests in your book, both the kind of movement screen type of testing, but also the performance and capacity testing that was outlined in your book was very accessible in the nature of those tests. But obviously your work is based at Loughborough University, so if you are working with a runner yourself sort of in a maybe a one-to-one basis, or however you might do it? Would you be looking to use the lab facilities at Loughborough to measure, I don't know, maybe things like an isometric mid-thigh pull or something like the eccentric utilization ratio? Not necessarily those two examples of tests, but, you know, more, I guess, for want of a better word, sciencey type tests that are perhaps a little bit less accessible to the everyday athlete.
It actually varies quite a lot. So as you kind of alluded to, what I tried to put across in my book is just a set of tests that people could do either at home or with like very, very minimal equipment and get some meaningful results where they could track their progress over time. And I still kind of rely on those to quite a large extent myself, particularly if I'm working with a young runner or I'm in a scenario where the laboratory isn't available, I'm not allowed to use it for a certain reason. And so I'm more than happy to go to those kind of more field-based tests.
Yeah.
If I have got a laboratory available, and I guess in an environment like Loughborough University, I'm very lucky. Or if I'm doing a scientific study and we want to take some more kind of valid and robust measurements of strength-based qualities, the testing battery that I would tend to use is a counter movement jump on a force plate to kind of get an indirect impression of explosive strength. We'll do what's called a reactive strength index profile across a range of different heights to assess plyometric capabilities. So that will usually be a drop jump from a 10 centimeter box, a 30 centimeter box, a 50 centimeter box, and sometimes, if it's an elite middle distance runner, a 70 centimeter box. And so, yeah, you get an idea of kind of how bouncy they are given higher amounts of eccentric loading that they've got to cope with. We then do, either an isometric quarter squat or an isometric mid-thigh pull. Like I've tended to use the quarter squat in the past. So I've got a bit more of my own data on that.
Yeah.
And then more recently, I've used a calf or an ankle plantar flexion maximal voluntary contraction. So that's usually with the participant sitting down on a chair and they have their ankle and their knee at 90 degrees. And then you place a fixed bar across their thigh and they essentially try to push against the bar as hard as possible. And their foot's positioned on a force plate. So you can get an idea of the highest amount of force that their calf muscles can develop. So it's mostly those four or five tests plus some of the other movement screening that we've already spoken about.
Yeah.
And again, I think going back to the previous question, for middle distance runners, I'm usually pretty sure what would be an excellent score, a kind of satisfactory score, and what would be a poor score. For long distance runners, I'm a little bit less concerned about grouping them like that. Mm-hmm. And then for all types of runners, what I'm mainly using these tests for is to kind of track progress over time. So I won't necessarily give them a ton of feedback and say, oh, you're really, really bad at this test. We need to sort it out. It's usually a case of, okay, for you, we're going to put you on a strength training program that's a bit more individualized and personalized for you as a runner. And then in 3 months' time, we're going to retest you on these things. And what I'm hoping for is we're going to see some improvements. And so it's a way for them to kind of gauge the progress and to just kind of motivate themselves to engage with some strength training. So yeah, hopefully that kind of gives you a bit of insight into, as you say, the more sciencey tests.
Yeah, well, maybe just delve into this a little bit more. So I guess you highlighted a few. You sort of a counter movement jump, which I guess is more for like testing muscular power, I guess.
Yeah.
And then some of the other ones you mentioned, like the isometric quarter squats.
Yeah.
I guess from my perspective, I'd kind of envisage that's looking at maybe your ability to generate knee stiffness, something like that, which is kind of one of the key kind of qualities we're looking for as runners. And then maybe the calf. Is that an isometric test as well, did you say?
The calf one and the squat are both isometric.
So both those kind of isometric tests might be related to sort of stiffness around the relative joint, stiffness around the ankle, around the knee. So and then that can help with programming. So if someone does quite well in the isometric test but not so well in the counter movement jump test, then perhaps they need more training directed at explosive strength or stiffness or that those kind of qualities. Or if it's the other way around, then they maybe need more general strength training that's going to enhance muscular power.
Absolutely, yeah. So yes, certainly with the middle distance runners, like it gives you an idea of where they're strong, where they're weak, based upon some normative data. And so, as you say, you can kind of bias the programming in certain areas and try to look to maintain other qualities and yeah, that's where testing becomes really useful for sure.
Cool. So, and that's kind of led us on a little bit away. So we've been talking about testing, but that particular discussion is kind of leading us into the area more of S&C prescription. So let's have a little look at that specifically now. And I guess in a world of social media, it's very common to see people putting out quite dogmatic statements. So for runners, I guess an example would be like, strength training for runners needs to be heavy loads, low repetitions, because you get all the endurance you need from your actual runnings. I feel like you'd probably be in kind of agreement with that, but it's a fairly dogmatic statement. And I think what I noticed in your book is you kind of said stuff along those lines, but in a much more nuanced approach. So what I mean by that is you considered various different elements. So you considered loading recommendations from a few perspectives, things like the nervous system adaptation, bone and connective tissue adaptation, and you've considered factors as well, such as bilateral versus unilateral loading and how things might differ with, say, tissue conditioning rather than other aspects of training. So it was a bit more of a holistic perspective rather than just saying heavy loads, low repetitions, and that's it.
Yeah. No, exactly. And yeah, there is certainly a lot to unpack here in terms of kind of appropriate repetition ranges. And yeah, I'm glad you kind of recognize that with what I was trying to put across in my book a little bit. But I'd go a step further to kind of say, I think even since that was published, I've probably softened my stance a little bit even more, just because, again, if we look to the research, and this is quite recent research over the last sort of 5 to 10 years, with individuals that have never done any strength training before and they haven't really engaged with any form of resistance training exercise, like the majority of the research evidence suggests that the repetition range, surprisingly, doesn't really matter that much. That as long as you get individuals working like hard, in inverted commas, and what I mean by that is quite close to repetition failure, whether they do 2 reps and they go to like a 2 rep max, or whether they do 20 reps and they're sort of about the 24 rep max, let's say, the percentage improvement in strength on whatever the exercise is going to be approximately the same. So it doesn't really matter too much. Like I would still kind of say for most runners, and this includes those that haven't done much S&C before, there's probably no point in going really high with repetition ranges. So not necessarily as high as 20, because it tends to create similar mechanisms of fatigue as they experience in running. And so that's then not great for the running, because they'll go and try and do a hard session and they'll be a little bit tired. And it tends to also create a little bit more soreness, just because of the number of kind of eccentric regimes of work that the muscle's gone through. And so I would still say that like lower is probably suitable and good for all types of runners. But I wouldn't be, as you kind of suggested, I wouldn't be as harsh as to say all runners need to do 3 to 5 reps. It needs to be heavy no matter what, like every exercise, every type of runner. I think that's too much of a, as you say, a dogmatic statement. And so if runners that are new to S&C, that if they want to do 10 repetitions or 12 repetitions, like I would suggest that's completely fine. And it's still relatively low. And they're probably going to get as much benefit as they would do from doing 2 or 3 reps at a much heavier load. Where it starts to change, and again, this is what we know from the research evidence, is that with those that are more experienced at strength training exercise, so if you have a runner that's been doing it for several years, if they want to try and improve their maximal strength, they probably are going to benefit more from doing lower repetition ranges. So probably no more than about 6 repetitions or so. So that's, again, where you've got to individualize it a little bit based upon training experience. Again, for the novice, a key rationale for going a little bit higher with the repetition range, particularly on more multi-joint complex skills, is there's obviously an element of skill acquisition. That going back to our kind of movement screening conversation, if you've got a runner that's not particularly familiar with the movement, they're still kind of practicing it, and it looks a bit inconsistent repetition to repetition, it's not going to be safe to go, okay, let's load that exercise up and just do 4 reps. Like it probably makes more sense to work with body weight or a very light load and go to kind of 10 to 12 reps, because it gives them the opportunity just to kind of practice the skill a little bit more and bed down the kind of technique points that you're providing them with. And then you can move further down the repetition range as they get stronger and a little bit more skilled at doing the exercise. I think the only other point to mention that you kind of alluded to before is, again, it is a little bit kind of tissue dependent. So it depends what our kind of goal is for the exercise itself. So like certainly with the neuromuscular system, we've kind of discussed improvements in strength in novices. It doesn't seem to matter too much what the repetition range is. But if we're trying to target changes in bone mineral density, changes in tendon stiffness and tendon resilience, and then other types of connective tissue, like there's some pretty good evidence that most of those will respond to heavier loads. And yeah, even if the load's like isometric in nature. So it makes more sense if the key goal for the exercise is trying to change tendon properties, that we do go quite heavy with the exercise. And if the athlete's not able to cope with the load or the skill, like keep it as a static isometric contraction, because it reduces the kind of skill element of the exercise. There's kind of other scenarios like rehabilitation as well, and bilateral versus unilateral. And again, it's probably a more nuanced approach with those sorts of goals and exercises. And so, yeah, you need to sort of treat it on an individual by individual basis and an exercise by exercise basis.
Yeah, very good. So specifically relating to what you kind of just started talking about with the tendons, obviously yeah. Saying that we need to, if we are going to chase specific tendon adaptations, we probably do need to go heavier. Yeah. And you specifically mentioned isometric work as well there. So I think, would it be fair to say there's a fair body of evidence suggests that we probably want to be working isometrically rather than in a traditional format with those like heavy isometrics rather than concentric work when we're chasing tendon adaptations as well, or perhaps eccentrics as well, or
I'd usually go with a little bit of both. I think like going sort of 15, 20 years back, there was quite a lot of evidence emerging around the use of eccentric and like kind of supramaximal loads. So heavier than you can lift through a full range of movement. For driving changes in tendon adaptation. And a little bit more recently, so more over the last decade, that's like most of the evidence seems to show that it doesn't really matter if it's concentric, eccentric or isometric, as long as the load's quite high. And so I'd tend to mix it up a little bit. Yeah. And certainly for those that aren't accustomed to doing strength training, like putting a load on them which is heavier than they can lift through an entire range of movement is a little bit daunting.
And
potentially risks injury, and there's maybe safety elements with some types of exercise. So I'd be a little bit cautious around going to supramaximal loads with those that aren't accustomed to doing it. And so working through full range or more simple skills would probably be more sensible for those that are just starting out.
So it really is, it's more about the loads than the type of contraction, and also just making sensible choices as well, really. Very good. Okay, so that kind of is starting to lead us onto a little bit, I guess, related to exercise selection a little bit as well. So we've kind of looked at eccentric versus isometric and concentric means of loading up, specifically in relation to tendon adaptation. But if we just move on to exercise selection in a bit more general terms now as well, and obviously this is clearly a very big area because there's a vast number of exercises out there that could be included in an S&C program. So I think I'll just try and keep this one fairly open-ended. If you could maybe talk more generally about principles of exercise selection, or alternatively, if you do want to go into more detail about a few specific exercises which are great for runners, kind of either way really, but it would be great to hear your thoughts on exercise selection for runners.
I guess I always kind of preface this type of question with, it always kind of depends a little bit. It's never a great answer, but like based on what we've already discussed around identifying what the athlete's strengths and weaknesses are, like what their specific strength and conditioning goals are, what access they've got to different facilities and equipment potentially, and what their training age is always going to drive exercise prescription to a large extent. But to try to generalize, I guess, some of the principles of S&C exercise prescription. So unsurprisingly, like all my sessions would usually start with like a movement skill-based warm-up. And this can be driven towards the sorts of skills and exercises that an athlete is struggling in, they can target sort of key muscle groups or joints that they've had injuries in the past potentially. So we can individualize it to quite a large extent. I think, yeah, maybe compared to other S&C coaches that are a bit more sort of traditional weights room based coaches, like for nearly all of the runners that I've worked with in the past, they'll have some form of plyometrics towards the start of the session. And so I won't necessarily like restrict the use of plyometrics to just a specific time of year. Like they'll typically do them year round. It will just vary in terms of the volume and the intensity of the types of plyometrics that they're doing. But typically that stage of the session would take about 10 to 15 minutes. And it will be something between about 50 and 100 foot contacts, depending upon the type of runner. So that'd be exercises such as doing pogo jumps, jumping over hurdles, things like hopping and bounding for more experienced runners. But I see that as quite an important component. And then in terms of the actual resistance or kind of weights-based training, like I'll usually want one or two exercises which are bilateral in nature and are attempting to load the hip and spine quite heavily. And so the two categories of exercise that I would work from are the hip hinging based exercises and squatting based exercises. So examples of hip hinging would be things like the Romanian deadlift and deadlifts from the ground. And obviously squatting is things like starting off with a goblet squat and then working towards front squats or back squats. Generally, the runners would then move on to doing one or two unilateral exercises. So I would pick from stepping based exercises and lunging exercises. So that might be something simple like a dead leg step up and doing a split squat, for example, and then building up over time to doing things like explosive box step ups and walking lunges. I'd then have some upper body work in there. Again, one or two exercises is usually fine, but this is largely just to balance out the kind of improvements in force development that they'll be experiencing in the lower body and to control the rotations that they're getting through their trunk. And so, yeah, I'd just pick from pull and push category upper body exercises. So an example of a pull exercise would be something like an inverted row or a single arm cable pull. And an example of a push exercise would be, I guess, starting off with a press up and working towards overhead pressing and bench pressing type exercises. And then to finish off the session, and it's arguably the most important part of the session in many ways, I would always have some sort of specific loading for either vulnerable tissues that are at risk of getting injured or injuries that the runner's nursing, so kind of niggles that they've currently got, or areas that they've been injured in the past quite a lot. So this might be areas like the calf and Achilles, which haven't really received a stimulus from the other exercises that I've mentioned, possibly the hamstrings, and possibly some targeted exercises for the trunk as well.
Very good. There's a few things could potentially dissect there, but we'll start out with what you just covered right at the end there with relating to the tissue conditioning, whether it's for vulnerable areas for runners in general, or whether it's something that's a bit more specific to that athlete. Maybe they are nursing a hamstring niggle or they have a history of hamstring niggles or whatever. I guess there's two schools of thought here. So you, in terms of, and I guess you've been alluding to with what you've said there, that you probably don't, correct me if I'm wrong, but I feel like you're alluding to that you would directly target that particular tissue and strengthen that tissue up. So which would be one school of thought. And then the other school of thought would be you strengthen the muscles around that muscle, for example, try and get the glutes as strong as possible. So that means the hamstrings don't have to do as much work when they're running because the glutes are more capable of taking on more of the work, which places the hamstrings at less risk that way. Do you subscribe to both schools of thought or what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I do. But both of those make sense. And with that specific example that you mentioned, like with exercises like the RDL and deadlifts and back squats, and then particularly stuff on one leg, like a dead leg step up, for example, like the glutes would have a fairly good stimulus from that. Like I might have had a sort of glute isolation exercise in as part of the warm up. Like there might be one in towards the end of the session as well. And so I'd be fairly happy that we've kind of, we've hit the glutes directly, whereas we haven't necessarily given the hamstrings like a really kind of strong stimulus. Mm-hmm. There's an opportunity towards the end of the session there to target any kind of joints, muscles, tissues which haven't received a direct stimulus from some of the bigger exercises within the session. Like if you have picked exercises within the session that do target those areas, yeah, you could potentially like leave them a little bit towards that back end of the session. But there's just an opportunity there to target and isolate any kind of areas that you haven't really targeted within the session that you see as important for that runner because of previous injuries or potentially areas that they might get injured.
Yeah, so I guess it's almost leaving a window at the end of the session to fill in the gaps a little bit. You know?
Yeah, a little bit.
And then now, just quickly on something you said at the very beginning of this particular question in relation to exercise selection was with the plyometric stuff, and you'd kind of start your sessions with that type of work. And I think you mentioned you'd allocate maybe 10, 15 minutes towards that kind of stuff. Do you have a particular number of like foot contacts that you're looking to achieve per session? Or I guess it depends on the intensity of the exercises as well.
But, yeah, just a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, with the lower intensity drills. So this is for young athletes and those that have never done sort of formal plyometric training as part of S&C. If they're doing like a kind of pogo jump where they're trying to minimize contact time, but it's a fairly low height, or they're doing like an A skip or a straight leg skip, which is again fairly low intensity, you can probably push the repetitions up to about 12 or maybe 15 or so without any kind of decrease in performance or kind of fatigue occurring. And yeah, and so like just doing two or three sets of those types of drills like quite quickly gets you up to sort of 50, 60 foot contacts, and then you can go into the next part of the session. With runners that are more experienced at doing plyometrics and they've nudged the intensity towards, I guess, kind of on an absolute scale, like moderate to high, like I'd try to stick to probably like 6 to 8 repetitions per set at very most. And so if they're doing 6 continuous hops in a row, or they're doing bounding for, I don't know, 15, 16 steps, that would represent kind of one set of work, or they're going over hurdles and there's 6 hurdles in a row. That would be sufficient before they need to have a recovery and then they go again.
Very good. So I guess sort of with the lower intensity stuff, maybe 12 to 15 contacts in a set-ish. And I think you said maybe 50 to 60 contacts in total for that part of the session. And then obviously you kind of suggested lower reps or contacts per set with the higher intensity stuff and a corresponding reduction in the total number of foot contacts as well, or not necessarily?
Yeah, not necessarily. So the total number of foot contacts can either stay roughly the same if intensity's recently increased, or could even nudge up a little bit.
Okay.
Like I think the most that I've ever had a runner doing is somewhere around about 100. And I would be excluding anything that's very low intensity for a runner like that, because they're probably not getting enough stimulus. It sort of still acts as a bit of a warm up for the more intense exercises. But if they're doing that twice a week, you usually see some quite noticeable gains in running economy or speed, or just kind of the way that they're feeling when they're running in terms of the stiffness that you were talking about before. Like they feel just a bit more reactive off the ground, which is just as meaningful. And yeah, that they get those benefits relatively quickly on that type of prescription.
And do you feel like you need to be strategic when those, say, those big number of foot contacts are placed, say 100 foot contacts in a session, would that need to be in like, say, a lower running mileage week or anything like that? Or can they generally tolerate that just fine anyway?
I guess this comes a bit more from the technical coach, but they tend to want to avoid it on sort of key race weeks.
Yeah.
And so they may not do any of it at all on a key race week, or maybe just one session like 5 or 6 days before it, which is completely fine. But yeah, generally through the winter months or in kind of preparatory off-season periods, they'll be doing those sorts of sessions twice a week. And like I try my best to encourage them to keep it going as long as possible into the summer. But again, that those sorts of decisions tend to be a little bit driven by what the philosophy of the technical coach is and how much sort of S&C they want them to be doing during a track season, for example.
Yeah. And with regard to the input of the technical coach as well, I guess this is something I wanted to ask you about anyway, but it kind of leads into us with regards to like the placement of strength and conditioning activities within the overall running training program. So it's obvious, of course, it's going to depend on what the technical coach wants to a large extent, but in more general terms, I guess this type of discussion usually revolves around kind of recovery. So with the assumption that, you know, the strength training might be performed later that day after a tough running session, or perhaps the following day after a tough running session. So, but kind of in close proximity to a tough running workout, so that you've got more time to then recover before your hard bouts. So we'll get your thoughts on that a little bit. But also, I noticed from your PhD thesis that you conducted a study using depth jumps as part of a warm-up to potentiate subsequent running performance. So it'd be great to look at kind of this idea of where to place the SNC activities from both those kind of perspectives, both like before running sessions as a potentiating thing, or after running sessions, and how you would place it from that point of view as well.
Yeah, it's a really topical and interesting area, this, and one that I get asked quite a lot about. And I think you've almost summarized them there, but there's probably three main approaches that I see SNC coaches and runners using. You've got, I guess, the sort of traditional format of planning the week, whereby you put the heavier strength training sessions on easier days. And the kind of the obvious rationale for that is, well, I want to be relatively fresh. I want to be kind of psychologically engaged with the session. So therefore, I'm going to place it as far away from my hard running sessions as possible. So I get both recovery for the S&C session and then recovery after the S&C session before the higher intensity work. And yeah, that first approach is one that I see a lot of runners using and seems to make a lot of sense. The second one, which I guess is probably a bit more contemporary because it only seems to have been employed more over the last 5 to 10 years, is placing the hard strength sessions on the same day as hard running sessions. So it's usually some form of interval training. Like, it seems to be more well-trained runners that seem to be using that type of approach. And the rationale being that you get kind of all of your hard physical training done on sort of all the physiological systems within one day. So therefore the following day, or maybe the following 2 days, are dedicated to just completely recovering. And so any form of exercise or easy running that you're doing is recovery exercise. And so therefore you can make sure you fully recover for other sessions. The advantage to doing that is, as I say, you can kind of polarize the week around very hard days and very easy days. I'd say the disadvantage is you've got to be a little bit careful on the types of training that you put in those sessions. So for example, if you do heavy resistance training, you can generally get away with it because you kind of just grind through the reps a little bit. Like, there's no need to be really explosive, or you haven't kind of got a time constraint on how long it's going to take you to complete each individual set. Whereas what we know from the research is if you're doing anything that involves explosive power or developing force very rapidly, such as doing plyometrics, it's very, very difficult to execute it to the same level of quality as if you were completely fresh. And so I'd be a little bit cautious over doing a hard session in the morning, and then in the afternoon trying to do some form of explosive or plyometric type work in that scenario. Like, you probably need to put it at least 24 hours after a hard running session. And then the third option that runners have got is kind of having some form of S&C, and this sounds kind of a little bit excessive, but having some form of S&C like almost every single day of the week. But instead of planning around S&C sessions, which I guess is what we've spoken about so far, like you do sort of two main sessions a week, you split those sessions up into maybe like 6 or 7 little training sessions. And that type of organization seems to work really well for runners that have got very busy lifestyles, or they don't really want to find a new 2-2.5 hours in the week to do 2 S&C sessions. And so they organize the S&C by putting 10 or 15 minutes before a run as kind of part of a kind of extended warm up, or they do 10 or 15 minutes after a run or a hard session. And so your example of the depth jumps for potentiation would be something that a runner could do to kind of microdose the plyometric element of their strength training as part of a warm-up before like any type of run, really. So not only are they getting some benefit from plyometric in the long term by doing that every single week, they're potentially getting some benefit acutely for the run that they're about to do. And yeah, that type of design seems to work quite nicely for some types of runners that like to do a little bit every single day. So yeah, there's three main approaches, I guess, and three options that listeners have got.
Yeah, and I guess that, well, you mentioned that the approach of sort of putting a full strength session on, or not necessarily a full, maybe taking the plyometrics out, but a strength session on later in the day after after a heavy interval session on the track, for example, that you mentioned that was more something that more well-trained runners tend to do. But I guess realistically, this all comes down to personal circumstances and lifestyle and stuff. That's probably something that's more applicable for a full-time athlete, or at the very least a student athlete. But you're going to struggle to get both those sessions in a day when you're working 9 to 5.
100%, yeah.
Whereas the opposite would be true with the microdosing approach. If someone's got a 9 to 5 job, they can just put bits in here, bits in there, and potentially still accumulate a similar overall amount of strength and conditioning work, but just in little bits at a time.
Yeah, and you've hit upon a really important point there, that with this type of question, it is like it's kind of thinking in depth, like kind of what's optimal, like what's going to get you the best physiological response. But yeah, I think for probably the vast majority of runners, like the most important thing is that they're just doing some form of strength and conditioning exercise, like where that's placed in the week, whether it's immediately after a hard session or a few hours after or 24 hours after, like it probably doesn't matter that much as long as they're engaging with it. Yeah. And the engaging with it part is probably the most important. And they're only going to eke out, I don't know, like an extra 1 or 2%. By trying to optimize it. But yeah, the optimization is sometimes at the expense of things going on in their life, and it's just not realistic or possible. And so it's sort of like, okay, I'll get it done at some point, and that's the most important thing, and the rest doesn't really matter too much.
Yeah, absolutely. So I think we've covered like a lot of ground here.
Yeah, we have. Yeah.
So I don't know if there's anything else you would add that we've kind of missed out, but I feel like we've been fairly comprehensive looking through various different aspects of consideration in terms of strength and conditioning for runners.
But yeah, certainly. Yeah. It feels like we've been really thorough and covered some great ground.
Yeah. I think so too. So with that in mind, thank you very much for coming on. It's been an absolute pleasure to have you here, Richard. If any of the listeners wants to, buy your book, Strength and Conditioning for Endurance Runners, that's the correct title, isn't it?
Yes.
So if they want to buy that, where's the best place to find it, perhaps?
Thanks very much for mentioning it, Tim. I do really appreciate it. So it's obviously available on Amazon. It was published by the Crowwood Press, so obviously you can get it on their website as well, but I imagine it's slightly cheaper on Amazon.
Yeah, and also, there's runners listening to it that might be interested in strength and conditioning coaching. Is that something you're off? Obviously, you're very busy as an academic at Loughborough University. Are you taking on coaching clients or anything like that? Are you open?
Yeah,
to
I mean, since I've started working at Loughborough, I've done a lot less coaching than before, just because the pressures of my job changed a little bit. So it's a bit more research orientated now. I'm still doing S&C coaching, but actually with a group of athletes that we've not spoken about at all on this call that are recovering from a syndrome known as relative energy deficiency in sport, which is often accompanied by eating disorders in very severe cases. So the coaching that I'm doing is working with young athletes that are recovering from eating disorders a lot of the time. And a lot of those are obviously endurance athletes, but I do little bits and pieces with, healthy runners as well.
Yeah, cool. So I guess there's no harm in getting in contact, but most likely the best course of action would be buy the book, because it is an excellent book, Strength and Conditioning for Endurance Runners. And
thanks, Tim.
And yeah, soak up the information that way, I guess. Thank you very much for coming on. Yeah, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Thanks very much again, Tim.